During that time, many an imperial general and three god emperors have led armies across the plains in turn to bring the nomads to heel. History tells us that such attempts seldom end well. The invaders may slaughter the herds of the nomads, burn their tents and yurts, collect tribute in the form of gold, goods and slaves from the bands they chance to encounter, and even compel a handful of Jets to vow eternal fealty to the god emperor and forswear raiding forever. But most Jogus Nahai flee before the imperial hosts, refusing to give battle, and sooner or later the general or emperor loses patience and turns back, whereupon life resumes as before. During the long reign of Lo Han, 42nd Scarlet Emperor, three such invasions of the plains ended as described. Yet the end of his days found the Jogus Nahai bolder and more rapacious than they had been when he first donned the imperial regalia. Upon his death, therefore, his young and valiant son, Lo Bu, determined to end the threat posed by the nomads for all time. Assembling a mighty host, said to be 300,000 strong, this bold young emperor crossed the frontiers with slaughter as his only purpose. Tribute could not sway him, nor hostages, nor oaths of fealty and offerings of peace. His vast army swept across the plains like a scythe, destroying all, leaving a burning wasteland behind it. When the Jogus Nahai resorted to their traditional tactics, melting away at his approach, Lo Bu divided his huge army into 13 smaller hosts and sent them forth in all directions to hunt down the nomads wherever they might go. It is written that 1 million Jogus Nahai died at their hands. At last the nomads, facing the extinction of their race, did what they had never done before. 1,000 rival clans joined together and raised up a Jatar, a woman in man's mail named Zia. Known as Zia the Barren, Zia Zorspace, and Zia the Cruel, and famed even then for her cunning, she is remembered to this day in the Golden Empire of Yi Ti, where mothers whisper her name to frighten unruly children into obedience. Encouraged valor and skill at arms, Lo Bu had no peer, but in cunning he proved to be no match for Zia. The war between the young emperor and the wizened Jatar lasted less than 2 years. Zia isolated each of Lo Bu's 13 armies, slew their scouts and foragers, starved them, denied them water, led them into wastelands and traps, and destroyed them each in turn. Finally, her swift riders descended upon Lo Bu's own host in a night of carnage and slaughter so terrible that every stream for 20 leagues around was choked with blood. Amongst the slain was Lo Bu himself, the 43rd and last of the Scarlet Emperors. When his severed head was presented to Zia, she commanded that the flesh be stripped from the bone so that his skull might be dipped in gold and made into a drinking cup. From that time to this, every Jatar of the Jogus Nahai has drunk fermented source milk from the gilded skull of the boy too bold by half, as Lo Bu is remembered. Leng. Southeast of Yin, surrounded by the warm green waters of the Jade Sea, the verdant Isle of Leng is home to 10,000 tigers and 10 million monkeys, or so Lomas Longstrider once claimed. The great apes of Leng are also far famed. Amongst them are spotted humpback apes, said to be almost as clever as men, and hooded apes, as large as giants, so strong they can pull the arms and legs off a man as easily as a boy might pull the wings off a fly. Leng's history goes back almost as far as that of Yi Ti itself, but little and less of it is known west of the Jade Straits. There are queer ruins in the depths of the island's jungle, massive buildings, long fallen, and so overgrown that rubble remains above the surface. But underground, we are told, endless labyrinths of tunnels lead to vast chambers, and carved steps descend hundreds of feet into the earth. No man can say who might have built these cities or when. They remain, perhaps, the only remnants of some vanished people. The present inhabitants of Leng are of two sorts, so utterly different from one another that we must regard them as entirely separate peoples. For much of its recent history, Leng has been part of the Golden Empire of Yi Ti, ruled from Yin or Jin Ki. During these epochs, tens of thousands of soldiers, merchants, adventurers, and sellswords made the migration from the empire to the island, seeking their fortunes. Though Leng broke free of Yi Ti 400 years ago, the northern two-thirds of the island are still dominated by the descendants of these Yi-Tish invaders. To the traveller, they remain indistinguishable from the people of the Golden Empire. They speak a dialect of the same language, pray to the same gods, eat the same foods, follow the same customs, and even reverence the Azure Emperor in Yin, though they worship only their own god empress. Their principal towns, Leng Yi and Leng Ma, resemble Yin and Jin Ki far more than they do Turani, the city to the south. On the southern third of Leng dwell the descendants of those displaced by the invaders from the Golden Empire. The native Lengi are perhaps the tallest of all the known races of mankind, with many men amongst them reaching 7 feet in height, and some as tall as 8, long-legged and slender, with flesh the colour of oil teak. They have large golden eyes and can supposedly see farther and better than other men, especially at night. Though formidably tall, the women of the Lengi are famously lithe and lovely, of surpassing beauty. For much of its history, Leng has been an isle of mystery, for the native Lengi seldom sail beyond sight of their own shores, and such seafarers who chanced to glimpse their coasts whilst crossing the Jade Sea met a cold reception should they dare to come ashore. The Lengi had no interest in foreign gods, foreign goods, foreign food, or dress or customs, nor did they allow outsiders to mine their gold, harvest their trees, gather their fruit, or fish their seas. Those who attempted to do so met a swift and bloody end. Leng became known as a haunt of demons and sorcerers, a place to be avoided, a closed island, and so it remained for many centuries. It was mariners from the Golden Empire who opened Leng to trade. Yet even then the island remained a perilous place for outsiders, for the Empress of Leng was known to have congress with the Old Ones, gods who lived deep below the ruined subterranean cities, and from time to time the Old Ones told her to put all the strangers on the island to death. This is known to have happened at least 4 times in the island's history, if Colloquo Votar's Jade Compendium can be believed.
Legends persist that the Old Ones still live beneath the jungle of Leng. So many of the warriors that Jaha sent down below the ruins return mad, or not at all, that the God Emperor finally decreed the vast underground city's ruins should be sealed up and forgotten. Even today, it is forbidden to enter such places, under penalty of torture and death.
not until Jaha, sixth of the Sea Green Emperors, conquered Leng with fire and steel and took it into his empire, did these slaughters cease for good and all. In the 4 centuries since Leng threw off the yoke of Yi Ti, the island has flourished under the rule of a long line of god empresses. The first of the current dynasty still revered in the east as Kyara the Great was of pure Lengi descent. To please her subjects, she took 2 husbands, one Lengi and one Yitish. This custom was continued by her daughters and their daughters in turn. By tradition, the first of the imperial consorts commands the empress's armies, the second her fleets.
Other islands of note in the Jade Sea, as recorded by Corlys Velaryon in his letters. The Isle of Elephants, whose Shan rules from a palace made of ivory. Marahai, the Paradise Isle, a verdant crescent attended by twin fire islands where burning mountains belch plumes of molten stone day and night. The Isle of Whips, a bleak and barren way station where slavers from 6 lands buy, sell, breed, break, and brand their chattel before sending them onward.
Ashai by the Shadow. And so we come nearly to the end of the world, or at least the end of our knowledge. Easternmost and southernmost of the great cities of the known world, the ancient port of Ashai stands at the end of a long wedge of land, on the point where the Jade Sea meets the Saffron Straits. Its origins are lost in the mists of time. Even the Ashai do not claim to know who built their city. They will say only that a city has stood here since the world began, and will stand here until it ends. Few places in the known world are as remote as Ashai, and fewer are as forbidding. Travelers tell us that the city is built entirely of black stone. Halls, hovels, temples, palaces, streets, walls, bazaars, all. Some say as well that the stone of Ashai has a greasy, unpleasant feel to it, that it seems to drink the light, dimming tapers and torches and hearth fires alike. The nights are very black in Ashai, all agree, and even the brightest days of summer are somehow grey and gloomy. Ashai is a large city, sprawling out for leagues on both banks of the Black River Ash. Behind its enormous land walls is ground enough for Volantis, Carth, and King's Landing to stand side by side and still have room for Old Town. Yet the population of Ashai is no greater than that of a good-sized market town. By night the streets are deserted, and only 1 building in 10 shows a light. Even at the height of day, there are no crowds to be seen, no tradesmen shouting their wares in noisy markets, no women gossiping at a well. Those who walk the streets of Ashai are masked and veiled, and have a furtive air about them. Oft as not, they walk alone, or ride in palanquins of ebony and iron, hidden behind dark curtains, and borne through the dark streets upon the backs of slaves. And there are no children in Ashai.
An account by Archmaester Marwyn confirms reports that no man rides in Ashai, be he warrior, merchant, or prince. There are no horses in Ashai, no elephants, no mules, no donkeys, no zorses, no camels, no dogs. Such beasts, when brought there by ship, soon die. The malign influence of the ash and its polluted waters have been implicated, As it is well understood from Harman's On Miasmas that animals are more sensitive to the foulness exuded by such waters, even without drinking them. Septon Barth's writings speculate more wildly, referring to the higher mysteries with little evidence.
Despite its forbidding aspects, Ashai by the Shadow has for many centuries been a thriving port where ships from all over the known world come to trade, crossing vast and stormy seas. Most arrive laden with foodstuffs and wine, for beyond the walls of Ashai little grows save ghost grass, whose glassy, glowing stalks are inedible. If not for the food brought in from across the sea, the Ashai would have starved. The ships bring casks of fresh water, too. The waters of the Ash glisten black beneath the noonday sun and glimmer with a pale green phosphorescence by night. And such fish as swim in the river are blind and twisted, so deformed and hideous to look upon that only fools and shadow binders will eat of their flesh. Every land beneath the sun has need of fruits and grains and vegetables, so one might ask why any mariner would sail to the ends of the earth when he might more easily sell his cargo to markets closer to home. The answer is gold. Beyond the walls of Ashai, food is scarce, but gold and gems are common. Though some will say that the gold of the Shadowlands is as unhealthy in its own way as the fruits that grow there. The ships come, nonetheless, for gold, for gems, and for other treasures. For certain things spoken of only in whispers, things that cannot be found anywhere upon the earth, save in the black bazaars of Ashai. The dark city by the Shadow is a city steeped in sorcery. Warlocks, wizards, alchemists, moon singers, red priests, black alchemists, necromancers, aeromancers, pyromancers, blood mages, torturers, inquisitors, poisoners, gods' wives, nightwalkers, shape-changers, worshippers of the black goat and the pale child and the lion of night, all find welcome in Ashai by the Shadow, where nothing is forbidden. Here they are free to practice their spells without restraint or censure, conduct their obscene rites, and fornicate with demons if that is their desire. Most sinister of all the sorcerers of Ashai are the Shadowbinders, whose lacquered masks hide their faces from the eyes of gods and men. They alone dare to go upriver past the walls of Ashai into the heart of darkness. On its way from the mountains of the Morn to the sea, the Ash runs howling through a narrow cleft in the mountains, between towering cliffs so steep and close that the river is perpetually in shadow, save for a few moments at midday when the sun is at its zenith. In the caves that pockmark the cliffs, demons and dragons, and worse, make their lairs. The farther from the city one goes, the more hideous and twisted these creatures become, until at last one stands before the doors of the Stygi, the corpse city at the Shadow's heart, where even the Shadowbinders fear to tread, or so the stories say. Is there any truth to these grim fables brought back from the end of the earth by singers and sailors and dabblers in sorcery? Who can say? Lomas Longstrider never saw Ashai by the Shadow. Even the sea snake never sailed so far. Those who did have not returned to tell us their tales. Until they do, Ashai and the Shadowlands and whatever lands and seas might lie beyond them must remain a closed book to wise men and kings alike. There is always more to know, more to see, more to learn. The world is vast and wondrous strange, and there are more things beneath the stars than even the archmaesters of the citadel can dream. Afterward. In the years since I first set pen to parchment, much has changed both in Westeros and beyond. Readers must understand that such a work as this is not the labor of a mere few weeks, or even years. I first set the framework for this history during the peaceful years at the height of good King Robert's reign, intending to dedicate the volume to Robert and his heirs, as a history of the land and the world that they had inherited. But such was not to be. The death of the noble hand, John Arryn, has unleashed a madness on the land, a madness of pride and violence. The madness has robbed the realm of Robert and of his fair son and heir, Joffrey. Pretenders strive to steal the Iron Throne, and disturbing rumors of dragons reborn trickle in from the east. In such times of trouble, we must all pray that good King Tommen shall see a long reign, and a just one, to usher us again out of the darkness and into the light. This is Roy de Trees. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The World of Ice and Fire, The Untold History of Westeros and the Game of Thrones by George R. R. Martin, Elio M. Garcia Jr., and Linda Antonsen. This program was directed by Fred Sanders and Cassandra Campbell. Executive producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2014 by George R. R. Martin. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.